Hi, everyone. My name is Mpochi Thapi, and this is TCS Plus, the business technology show which shines a spotlight on the thinkers, builders, and trailblazers shaping the ICT landscape in South Africa. I'm joined in studio today by Dr. Josephine Rosen. Welcome. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm fine, thank you. How are you? I'm happy to be here.
I'm very well, thank you. And it's great to have you. Now, just to introduce you, Dr. Rosen is the principal trustworthy AI specialist in SAS's data ethics practice, focused on governance and responsible AI adoption. She's also one of the co-authors of the groundbreaking report titled Constraint to Capability, Flipping the Narrative on AI in the Global South. So before we get into governance and all things AI, I'd really just love to know more about you, Dr. Rosen, and your journey and how it's led you to SAS.
Thank you. My journey into AI and governance was maybe a bit different since I actually originally trained as a pharmacist and started out as a clinical pharmacist in a hospital in Sweden, where I'm from. And on the hospital floor, you very quickly see how much decision-making about treatment and about risk and care depends on data. And you also see how serious the consequences are when these decisions go wrong, right? So that experience was what pulled me back into academia for a PhD at Uppsala University in a field called chemometrics, which sits at sort of the intersection of chemistry and mathematics and statistics. Looking back, I was actually working on what we'd now recognize as early foundation model ideas. I was navigating large complex data spaces to predict biological outcomes. And this was back in 2004, though. So it was long before we talked about AI the way we do today. And from there, I moved into industry, working with organizations across Europe, helping them make sense of data. And then about 14 years ago, I joined SAS, where I'm now part of our global data and AI ethics practice as the company's principal trustworthy AI specialist. And in this role, I work with governments and businesses around the world, supporting responsible AI adoption and AI governance. And what I do believe is that AI should serve people and societies and not the other way around. And that is, I think, what ultimately led me to focus on governance and trust and equity in AI, especially in regions where the stakes are high, where resources may be constrained and not the least where the opportunities are huge, as we'll discuss today.
Wow, that is quite the journey. And I love the career pivot. I imagine you couldn't possibly have known back then that, you know, this is where you would be in this space and really making a tangible difference, because I think, like you've said, AI should serve people and not the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, speaking about that, AI is definitely reshaping economies, and the benefits are not always evenly shared. And, you know, the research paper by SAS argues that the Global South doesn't have to catch up. It can actually shape AI differently and turn constraints into strategic advantages. And before we go into that, I just want to clarify for our listeners, who is the Global South?
Yeah. So when we talk about the Global South, we're not really talking about a single place or level of development. In the report, we use it to describe countries across Africa and Latin America, Asia, and Caribbean that share a history of colonialism and structural disadvantage in global economic and technology systems.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. And according to the report, you know, AI could add up to $15.7 trillion to the global economy by 2030. And yet the value capture is projected to be much lower for some reasons, like Latin America, like Africa and those Asian markets. And so what does flipping the narrative really mean in this context, and how do we do that?
Yeah, so So when we talk about flipping the narrative, we're really talking about challenging a very old story. And that is the idea that some countries are always catching up. And for a long time, the global South has been framed as being behind in technology and AI. And that framing quietly assumes that the future of AI is already defined somewhere else. And everyone else's role is simply to adopt it. And what we argue in the report is that this way of thinking isn't just incomplete, it's strategically wrong. Many countries across the global South, or what we often call also the global majority, are actually at a very unique moment. They're not yet locked into decades of old legacy AI systems or energy intensive infrastructure or governance models that were never designed for autonomous systems. And that gives them something early adopters didn't have, which is a much cleaner slate. So flipping the narrative is less about being late and more about having the chance to build things differently from the start. It means recognizing that constraints can actually lead to better designs. When bandwidth is limited, for instance, you build lighter models. And when energy is scarce, you optimize. When systems need to work across many languages and in formal contexts, you design for inclusion from the start. And those aren't really weaknesses. They are design disciplines that often lead to better AI. And why does this matter now? Well, because AI is no longer just a tool. It's becoming infrastructure. And it's shaping decisions in health and in finance, in education, in agriculture, really everywhere. And often with very little human oversight. And if countries don't shape that infrastructure early, through literacy and governance and representative data and sustainability that we're probably going to talk about, they risk inheriting systems that don't reflect their realities or values. So at its core, flipping the narrative is about agency. It's about moving from being passive recipients of AI to active co-creators of how it works in the real world. And that's, I guess, why this moment matters so much right now.
Sure. So it's a story about agency. And I think in Africa, we have these T-shirts which says, Africa, the time is now. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone sort of walks around with those T-shirts, and I think it's really cool. Mm-hmm. But you also write that the time is now, the window is narrow, but it's open. Mm. So what closes that window and what does acting now look like?
Well, what closes a window isn't one dramatic moment. It's, I would say, it's drift. The window closes when early choices quietly harden into lock-in, when data flows are outsourced without conditions, when compute dependence becomes permanent, when governance arrives only after AI is already embedded in, for instance, healthcare or finance or public services. And one big driver of that lock-in is the rise of more autonomous systems that we're seeing at the moment. Once they are deployed at scale, it becomes extremely difficult and also expensive to try to retrofit, you know, the safeguards, transparency or human oversight. Because governance works best when it's designed into the system and not bolted on later. And another one is infrastructure dependency. If countries rely entirely on offshore compute, for instance, they may gain access but lose leverage. And once that dependency becomes structural, sovereignty is very hard to reclaim. And there is also representational risk. If local languages and lived realities are missing from training data, those blind spots get baked into systems for years. But the hopeful part, I guess, is that we're not there yet. So across the global majority, we're already seeing mobile-first AI. We see smaller local language models and more flexible governance. And that tells us that the window is still open, but it won't stay open forever. So that's, I guess, what we're trying to see.
I love what you said there about, you know, governance by design and really trying to shape that from the outset and not retrospectively. Mm. And you touched a bit as well about the representation and, you know, that divide and what that looks like. How can Africa's demographic advantage or translate into AI leadership?
Yes, when people talk about Africa's demographic advantage, they often stop at the headline that, you know, it's the youngest continent in the world. But youth alone doesn't create leadership, right? So what matters is that this is also the most digitally native generation Africa's ever had. People who grew up with mobile first and platform first and often leapfrogging traditional infrastructure altogether. And that changes how AI can be designed and deployed. So in the report, we discuss how that leadership doesn't come from building the biggest models. It comes from solving the hardest real-world problems under constraints. And Africa has been doing that for decades. And they've been doing mobile banking and digital ID or health and agriculture tools that were built for low bandwidth. And these are not extreme innovations, but they're previews of what efficient, accessible AI look like globally. Mm. So I guess the opportunity is to translate demographic energy into capability by pairing this youth optimism with AI literacy, by creating local pathways so talent builds here instead of leaving, and by designing AI that works in local language, that work in informal economies and public service contexts. So if that happens, I think Africa doesn't just adopt AI, it helps define what human-centered, resource-efficient AI looks like for the rest of the world, potentially.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I love what you've said there about AI literacy. What is AI literacy? You know, how can we quantify or demonstrate it for citizens and civil servants and executives that are leading in businesses?
Yeah, so, well, AI literacy is often misunderstood as learning how to code or lately maybe even, you know, how to use ChatGPT, right? But that's not what we mean here. So in the report, we describe AI literacy as ability to use and to question and govern AI systems safely and meaningfully at every level of society, really. So for citizens, it means understanding when AI is being used, what it can do, what it cannot do, and how to challenge decisions that affect their lives, whether that's access to credit or jobs or public services. And for civil servants, it's about knowing how to procure AI responsibly, how to ask the right questions from vendors, how to ensure systems align with constitutional rights and transparency and public value, not just efficiency, right? And for executives, AI literacy is more, I would say, strategic. It's understanding the trade-offs, like speed versus trust, automation versus accountability, and scale versus sustainability. So leaders, they don't need to build models, right? But they do need to understand the consequences. And without that shared literacy, I think AI becomes something that happens to society, like we're talking about before, and not with it. So that's super important.
Yeah, I think the golden thread that you've highlighted there is just responsibility at all levels and understanding, you know, the true implications of AI as it presents itself in different situations. And, you know, moving on to policy and where we are as a country. I mean, we've adopted a national paper or national framework rather for AI. So we don't have any real hard laws at the moment regarding AI. And given where we are, what role does South Africa play as a potential anchor for that responsible use of AI?
Well, so South Africa is actually in a really strong position to play this role, not because everything is perfect, but because a few important things come together here. For one, there is real institutional strength, strong universities, solid legal and constitutional tradition, and a public sector that knows how to work it at scale. There's also regional influence, I would say. What South Africa tests or pilots, whether in policy or procurement or standards, often shapes conversations far beyond its own borders. And importantly, the work has already started with the National AI Plan and the AI Policy Framework. They mentioned South Africa has made its direction public, moving toward more human-centered, risk-based way of approaching AI. And if South Africa uses the moment to bring others together to test what good governance looks like in practice and adapt global ideas to African realities, it can absolutely become a reference point, not just for rules, but for how responsible AI is actually done.
Now, we have a tendency to, you know, check what the North, the global North is doing and then apply it locally. So what do you believe are some of the things that we can copy from the global North, and what do you think we should steer clear of doing?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And I think it's really important here to be selective. What many countries should avoid copying from the global North is the idea that bigger is always better. And that includes very energy heavy models, governance that only shows up after things have gone wrong, and data practices that, you know, where the value quietly flows out without coming back. And those, because those choices are really hard and expensive to undo later. What is worth coping, though, and fast, I guess, is different. Things like focusing rules where the risks are highest, putting checks and accountability in place early, building partnerships that are clearly tied to public value, not just speed or efficiency. I think the Global North is really offering useful lessons, but not ready-made templates, of course. So the real opportunity is to take what works, leave the rest behind, and design AI in a way that fits South Africa's values and priorities and regional role. And I guess that's how you build something stable. And that's also how, you know, anchors could be formed, right? And I think that's also where the opportunity really lies here.
Okay, so so some discernment is required. You know, we don't just have a copy and paste.
No.
And I want to touch a bit on governance. And, you know, you spoke about it being very difficult to fix retrospectively. How can governance flexibility, you know, become a competitive advantage as we are trying to develop our own frameworks, as companies are trying to develop their own framework? How can we use that to our advantage?
When we talk about governance as a competitive advantage, we're really pushing back on a very common belief, not only in Africa, but everywhere, that regulation automatically would slow down innovation. But I would say it's almost the opposite. So many countries across the global majority aren't locked into old AI systems or complicated rule books yet. Being a second mover, as we call it many times in the report, instead creates an opportunity to build ethics and sustainability and accountability into the systems from the start, instead of having to fix those problems mm-hmm. afterwards when it's, like I said before, far more expensive. And this, I guess, flexibility means that you can focus on governance where it really matters, on high impact and high risk use cases first. You can design rules that fit local institutions, and you can align AI deployment much more closely with development goals rather than importing one size fits all frameworks, right? And the reason this becomes a real advantage is simply trust. Trust is hard to earn, and it's easy to lose, right? So systems that people can understand and question and also recognize as grounded in their own context tend to face less pushback. They tend to get used more quickly, and they also reduce a risk for everyone involved. So I believe it's important to think that governance, when governance makes it easier to do the right thing instead of getting in the way, then it stops holding innovation back, and instead it allows innovation to actually last.
Sure. And I think you touched on how the approach in South Africa has been seemingly human-centered. You know, we're known for having one of the best constitutions in the world. And it would really be great to see some of those human-centered principles, you know, translate into how we form governance and ethics around AI. And, you know, that brings me to my next question around why representative data is so critical. You know, we're also in one of the most unequal societies in the world. And so what is the importance of representative data, and what is the risk that's posed by Western-centric data sets?
So AI systems always learn from the past. So, of course, whose past they learn from becomes very important, because data is how AI decide what normal looks like, right? So today, many AI systems are trained, as you know, mainly on data from Western high-income settings. And when those systems are used in different parts of the world, they don't just work less well. They can actually also cause harm. So decisions about, for instance, health and credit and content moderation or public safety can go wrong simply because the data doesn't reflect people's everyday lives, their languages, or their realities. And this isn't just a technical issue, because when people repeatedly see systems that don't recognize them or their context, then again, trust, right? Trust disappears. And without trust, people won't use the systems, no matter how good they are.
Sure. That's so true. And the paper, you know, specifically mentions that there are 200 million plus Swahili speakers, but there's a scarce training data for this. So what does that actually mean for safety and moderation in addition to the lack of trust that you've touched on?
Yes, the Swahili example really brings this to life, I think. You know, when a language spoken by more than 200 million people isn't well represented in training data, then problems show up very quickly. Safety systems struggle, harmful content or misinformation can slip through simply because the model doesn't fully understand what's being said, right? So moderation becomes uneven. Sometimes too much is taken down and sometimes not enough. And both are frustrating for the communities that are affected. And in public facing systems, especially things like healthcare or public services, this can lead to misunderstandings or even advice that are just not reliable. And over time, people notice this again and again, trust fades, and it starts to feel like these systems weren't built for them or not built with them in mind. And that's really the point we're trying to make, I guess, in the report, that language gaps aren't just technical issues. They affect safety and they affect trust and ultimately how well AI also can be governed.
Yeah, it's a very visceral reminder that, you know, you can have this large demographic and they're so underrepresented. Mm. And that brings me to the concept of synthetic data. Mm-hmm. You know, is it a silver bullet? Can it address certain bias that may show up in data sets? Or can it actually amplify that bias? So maybe explain to us what is synthetic data, and then we can explore the bias question some more.
Yeah, exactly. So synthetic data is data that is generated with algorithms, right? It learns from real mm-hmm. data and it creates more data. And it doesn't, like I say, doesn't present a magic solution. It can absolutely help mm-hmm. and it can be very useful, but it can also harm if we're not careful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can help, like I said, when data is scarce, so it can fill up the holes. It can improve representation for undersampled or minority groups, because, you know, if you have too little of some minorities, for instance, you can fill up those gaps and make it evenly represented. It can reduce privacy risks because you know if there's mm-hmm. data that you cannot use because it's sensitive or forbidden to use, you can create synthetic data that can be used instead, and then you can research certain problems that you couldn't do before, and you can support innovation mm-hmm. in contexts where real world data is limited or sensitive. So it's especially used for fulfilling gaps or rare cases where collecting real data is difficult or risky. Mm-hmm. But like I said, synthetic data generation is AI. So just like all AI, it learns from training data. And in this case, it learns from something real, from real data. So if the original data is incomplete, if the original data is biased or mm-hmm. missing important perspectives, then synthetic data will carry those issues forward. And sometimes even strengthen them and amplify them, like you said. So like all AI, it depends on oversight and a solid governance framework. It is more like a complement to real data. And I believe that in the Global South, it can serve very well as a bridge while, you know, we're building stronger, more inclusive data ecosystems. So It's definitely useful, but like you say, not a, what did you call it, a silver bullet or a magic?
A silver
yeah.
bullet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm learning that there are no silver bullets when it comes to AI, only strong practices and frameworks, ethics, accountability, and those are all aspects that you've touched on.
Mm-hmm.
And let's move to use cases. Mm-hmm. What do you believe are the most promising AI use cases in health, where you've worked, in education and in finance?
Well, the most promising use cases in this context aren't, first of all, flashy headline examples. They're, mm-hmm. I think, the ones that solve real problems at scale and under real-world conditions. So in health, that often means AI that helps extend care to more people. For example, tools that support community health workers by helping them decide what kind of follow-up a patient might need, or systems that guide basic care through a mobile phone, sometimes just through voice or text and in local language, of course. And in places where doctors are few and records are still mostly on paper, that kind of support can make a very real difference. And you said in education, I would say the opportunity is about support at scale. And in the report, we point to AI tools that help teachers rather than replacing them. For example, learning support that works in local language, again, that adapts to different levels and helps manage, you know, many times overcrowded classrooms. And finance, I'd say the strongest use cases are about access. Things like helping people build credit profile without a traditional bank history, to spot unusual activity in mobile money or supporting small businesses with better financial insights. So we've already seen how mobile payments leapfrog traditional banking, right? Mm-hmm. And AI can do similar things for credit and for insurance. And I think what links all of these is that they lower the barriers to healthcare, yes, to learning, to economic mm-hmm. participation, instead of just making, you know, already well-served systems more efficient, which is usually the case in yes. other parts.
Yes, it should definitely be advancing humanity, democratizing access, like you said, you know, removing barriers. I think that's really the one of the best ways that we can use this technology. Mm. And what are some of the good use cases that you've seen with private and public sector partnerships?
I would say, let me see, sorry. Without naming any specifically, I'd say partnerships that really work tend to have a few things in common. Let's see, first, they start with a clear public purpose, improving health or widening access or building resilience, not just making systems faster or cheaper. Second, there's also genuine sharing of responsibility and value. Governments bring, you know, credibility and scale, and companies would bring skills and technology, but the benefits don't all flow just one way, right? So, and third, governance is built in from the beginning, of course, things like transparency, trusted ways of handling data, building local skills, those are not added on later. They're part of the design from the beginning. So yes. I think when public-private partnerships work well, they just don't deliver technology. They leave behind stronger institutions, and also super important, mm-hmm. again, you know, greater trust.
I really hope some of our politicians are taking notes, because this is our municipal elections year and national elections are coming up. And I really think that as part of their campaigns, they should be positioning, you know, how these kinds of partnerships and these use cases can really be used to advance and to help people. So let's hope they are taking notes.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, the report says that about 3 billion people are still offline. And, you know, it begs the question, who is the AI being built for? You know, the report notes that nearly 3 billion people remain offline and mostly, you know, in that global south. Who is it being built for if we are not, you know, subscribed to that AI infrastructure and we're not really getting its benefit?
So right now, mostly for people who already have power, connectivity and data, I guess that's the uncomfortable truth. AI systems are trained on the lives of those who've been online for decades, which means yes. billions of people are effectively invisible to these models. So I guess if we don't address connectivity and literacy and language representation, then AI risks becoming a force, sort of multiplier for existing inequality. And in the report, we discuss why mobile first and offline capable and low bandwidth AI isn't second best. It's future proof, we say. If AI doesn't meet people where they are, then it won't scale, and it won't scale sustainably.
Absolutely. We need that inclusivity, not only from a representation point of view, but I think as a basic human right, you know, to have access to these kinds of things. And, you know, the world may not have always seen connectivity as a basic human right. But I think the more we become technologically advanced and some people get left behind as a result, it really becomes a humanitarian issue. So, just before we wrap up, if we fast forwarded 5 years from now, and I know 5 years in AI years is like 30 days.
Yeah, at least.
It's so fast moving. Yeah. But if we were to fast forward 5 years, what would you, what would convince you that Africa and South Africa moved from being rule takers to rule makers in this global landscape?
Well, if we fast forward 5 years, I'd be looking for a few clear signals. First, AI systems that actually work in local language and real world settings, not just as pilots, but at scale. That would tell me design is being driven by local needs and not assumptions imported from somewhere else. Second, I think governance approaches coming out of Africa and South Africa that others start to point to, not because they're copied word for word, but because they're practical and trusted, and they work in complex real conditions. And I think third, clear signs that value stays local. That means stronger institutions, skills being built and kept, and shared infrastructure that reduces dependency, and people who understand AI can question AI and see it working in their interests. I think when choices made here in South Africa start shaping how AI is built and governed elsewhere, that's when we're really moved from taking rules to helping write them. And I would like to see that.
Yeah, I think the ground is very fertile for us to be those rule makers, and I'm really hopeful about that. And you know, one final thought from you. If you could leave South African policymakers and business leaders with just one action to take in the next 90 days, what would that be and why?
That's a good one and a difficult one too. That could have a lot of different answers. But I believe I would ask them to pick one public use case that really matters in health or education, or finance, and build it with governance embedded from day one. Not as a tech pilot, but as something meant to work in the real world with clear responsibility and representative data, as we spoke about, in human oversight and outcomes you can actually measure. I think a very practical way to do that is through a shared AI assurance, a sandbox where governments and universities and businesses can test systems together, see what works and fix what doesn't, and build confidence before scaling. And this is a small, deliberate step, but I believe it would definitely create momentum. And when the window is narrow, it's often those early thoughtful steps that shape where things end up for years. And that is also really one of the key messages we want to highlight with our report, I'd say.
Well, to our business leaders and policymakers, Dr. Rosen has given you the blueprint for the next 90 days. It's a really exciting time. I really think that it's a time for bold leadership, pioneers to really come to the fore and, you know, position these countries, position Africa where it can be and really change, as you said, that narrative. But Dr. Rosen, I could pick your brain all day. Thank you so much for your time. It has really been such a thrilling discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.